All right, let's get started. Sorry to cut that short, but you get the idea. We're going back to Earth. All right, and here we are, and we made it back, and now we can talk about exchange, which is awesome. All right, so for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the exchange team. And in this session, we're going to go over Exchange 2013 deployment and coexistence. So we're going to get you ready to deploy it. Once it's out there and available for you, and you'll understand exactly what you need to do to prepare your existing environment for going from wherever you are now to Exchange 2013. Let's just see where everybody is. How many of you are still on Exchange 2003? All right. 2007? 2010? Awesome. Wow, great mix. Anybody earlier than 2003? No? Okay. Excellent. Well, the presentation I'm going to show you, just like the other two presentations I've already done here, are about pre-release software, which means everything I'm going to tell you is subject to change, and any screenshots and things like that could change by the time we release the product. Now, having said that, I don't expect anything to change at all. I'm pretty sure everything I'm going to tell you is going to be there at RTM. But again, it's pre-release, so things could change, so we do have to caveat it with that disclaimer. The agenda is very straightforward. I'm going to talk briefly about the fundamentals of deployment, the prerequisites that you'll need both for the servers on which you'll deploy 2013 and in the environment, in your AD environment, what changes, if any, you may need to make just to prepare yourself for it. We're also going to talk about upgrade and coexistence. We're going to talk about the upgrade and coexistence scenario for Exchange 2007 and Exchange 2010. I will touch briefly on what's needed for Exchange 2003 to 2013 coexistence, but it's not as straightforward with 2003. We'll also talk about public folder migrations. How many of you are using public folders today? How many of you want to continue using public folders in Exchange 2013? Many fewer hands. Well, okay, we'll talk about what that means later. And then we'll also talk about virtualization. How many of you are virtualizing Exchange today? And how many of you want to continue to virtualize Exchange? Excellent. Okay. All right, let's talk about the prerequisites. So this should come as no surprise, as with every release, there are certain requirements that we have to have in order for you to be able to deploy the product. So this is nothing new or earth-shattering with Exchange 2013. And in fact, if you look at the requirements that we have, in many ways they're very similar to some of the requirements we had for 2010 and even back in the day with 2007 as well. Now, the supported coexistence scenarios, which means the organizations into which you can introduce Exchange 2013, are organizations with Exchange 2007 and later. So if you have Exchange 2003 or earlier, you cannot introduce Exchange 2013 into that same Active Directory forest. You would have to do a new forest and then do a cross-forest move from 2003 to 2013. And that's actually not as difficult as it sounds. If you were doing a cross-forest move in 2003 going to 2003, back then there was a lot of pain. But 2003 to 2013, it's much, much simpler because we're designed with cross-work functionality in mind, because after all, that's what every hybrid deployment is. It's a cross-work functionality. So going from 2003 to 2013 isn't too bad, but you will have to do a cross-forest migration. But if you do have 2007 and or only 2010 in the mix, then life is much better. You will need what we're calling a coexistence update. So for 2010, that's going to be Service Pack 3. It's not out yet, but it will be by the time it's needed. And for 2007, it's Service Pack 3 plus an update rollup, which will be our coexistence vehicle for that. We actually believe that update rollup 8, which is the latest update for 2007 SP3, is going to be that rollup. So that's already out there. You could deploy that today. Maybe some of you already have. But that, again, could change. It could be that we need some other component and we would release that in a future rollup. But it is possible that the existing rollup for 2007 that's out there now is going to be our coexistence update. Client access methods. Well, again, no surprise. It's almost identical to what we were doing with 2010 with our N-2 clients. So the newest client, when Exchange 2013 comes out, will be Outlook 2013. So N-2 means Outlook 2013, Outlook 2010, and Outlook 2007. Earlier clients may work. We don't know. We don't test them. So we don't know if they're going to work or not. They may work, but your mileage may vary. They would not be supported clients. So if you do deploy them and you do have difficulty getting them to work, we wouldn't be able to help you with that because we don't pursue that scenario. So keep that in mind. And if you were in the architecture session, then you know that all Outlook connectivity now is over Outlook Anywhere or RPC over HTTP. No more MAPI over TCP for Outlook. It's all HTTP traffic now. Whoops, didn't mean to go forward there. Entourage for the Mac, how many of you have Mac users? Okay, you will need a new version, which again is not a surprise. We needed new versions when we went to Exchange 2010, when we removed WebDAV from the product and moved over to Exchange Web Services for Access Method. At that time, the Outlook and the Entourage clients for Mac also needed to be updated as well. All right, the prerequisites. You're probably not going to need to touch Active Directory because the requirements for AD are largely the same as what we had in 2007 and 2010. So really, you shouldn't need to make any changes. There shouldn't be any direct impact to your Active Directory infrastructure, except for the fact that, of course, we will be introducing schema modifications, as we tend to do with Exchange. And so there will be schema updates that will go throughout your environment, and we'll need to replicate to all your servers before you will continue with the deployment. As with earlier versions, you can do those schema updates separately, or you can do them as part of the first server installation. How many of you use read-only directory servers, RODCs, ROGCs? Okay, same support stance. Outlook and Exchange still need writable directory servers in order to function. You can have read-only directory servers in the organization. Outlook and Exchange will completely ignore them, but you do have to have writable directory servers in every site where you're going to have Exchange and in every site where you're going to have an Outlook user. Namespaces. Same support as what we had in 2010, including the non-standard namespaces that we really don't like, but we're supporting anyway because some customers are still using them and have been using them for a long time. Things like a single label domain, which instead of Microsoft.com would be a domain simply called Microsoft, very similar to a NetBIOS domain. Anybody using a single label domain here? A few of you? Okay. Again, we're still continuing to support that. You may want to consider getting out of that namespace because it's not a guarantee that we will always support that in the future. As far as the other non-standard namespaces, again, it's the same set that we supported in 2010 and 2007. Now, the prerequisites. Many of you have been doing Exchange for a long time now. You know that Exchange has been 64-bit for a while. That's not going to change. You still need to have a 64-bit server. We still support both the most recent and the previous operating system, so Windows Server 2012 and Windows Server 2008 R2 plus SP1 or later are the operating systems we support. Of course, with 2008 R2, you can use either the standard edition, which you'd likely use for your client access servers, and you can use the enterprise edition for your mailbox servers so that you can deploy a DAG. Windows 2012, there is no enterprise edition. It's just standard and data center. Both of those include the Windows failover clustering component, so you could use Windows Standard or Windows Data Center when deploying Exchange 2013. Pretty much the only difference between the two is the virtualization licensing that you get. So unless you're heavily into virtualization, you may find yourself deploying only Windows 2012 Standard Edition, which again includes clustering now. We also require IIS. We use the HTTP protocol a lot. We use Remote PowerShell, which is served through IIS. So IIS and some of its prerequisites are still required. But as with Exchange 2010, Exchange 2013 has the ability to install that stuff for you. So you don't have to do the extra step of going down the path of getting those prerequisites for the operating system. There are some prerequisites you will need to go get, though, things like Windows Remote Management and Windows PowerShell 3.0. And the Unified Communications Managed API, that's what we use for the UM stack that exists on the client access server and on the mailbox server. So you will have to get the proper version of UCMA and deploy that on both CAS and mailbox before you can install it. That is a necessary prereq. All right, let's talk about the upgrade and coexistence portion. And just a reminder, and of course for those of you who didn't get to attend the architecture session, I just want to briefly recap what the new functional layering looks like in Exchange 2013 compared to Exchange 2010. So if you didn't know, we've consolidated our server roles down from five roles down to effectively what will be three roles, but what we're shipping in RTM is the two roles, the CAS and the mailbox. Post-RTM, there will be an Edge server for Exchange 2013, but that won't be available at RTM. At RTM, we'll just have the two server roles. And the way we've split up the functionality is we've taken the authentication portion and the proxy portion, moved that up into the client access server, and then taken things like the assistance, the business logic, the protocol support, and of course the mailbox store and the content indexing all down on the mailbox server role as well. So that means we have all the same functionality you've come to enjoy with 2007 and 2010. You just have it in fewer server roles and much easier to deploy that way. So what does an upgrade path look like? It's very similar to an upgrade, say, for example, from 2007 to 2010, or from 2003 to 2007 to 2010. If you have an organization that has multiple sites, multiple internet-facing sites, you will choose one of them and start with that. If you only have one internet-facing site, you will start with that one. If you have no internet-facing sites, well, then that's just odd because you're not sending email to anybody, so you're in the wrong room. You should be in the networking room. Okay, but if you do have these sites, then you will want to always start with an internet-facing site. Just pick one of them. It doesn't really matter which one, whichever one's your favorite. Once you've done all of the internet-facing sites, then you would do the non-internet-facing sites. And in the meantime, while the non-internet-facing sites haven't been upgraded, communications will be proxied or redirected to them, depending on what version of Exchange they're running. So what we have up here is a very basic example. Here we've got Contoso.com, our favorite company, and they've got the internet-facing site and a non-internet-facing site. And I'll give you all the steps for the upgrade, and then we're going to sort of drill into each of the steps so you can understand how each one goes. So the first thing you need to do is get that coexistence update deployed throughout the organization. Okay, throughout the organization. So for Exchange 2007 and Exchange 2010, that means deploying that Service Pack 3 plus that roll-up update on every legacy server you have in the forest. Okay, that is a prerequisite. Unless and until you've gotten every legacy server up to that coexistence update, you won't be able to deploy 2013. And we need that. It's important because otherwise the down-level servers have no idea how to deal with the up-level servers. It is a required piece of code. Then, and you'll do this periodically through the environment, you're going to need to validate. So you're going to pre-validate at this point that everything's ready after you've deployed the update rollup. You do that with the built-in test commandlets that we have, and you can do that with external tools like the remote connectivity analyzer. How many of you have heard of that? The remote connectivity analyzer, or testexchangeconnectivity.com. Okay, if you haven't heard of that, check out that site because it's a web service that we run in our data center. You go to this website and it will test remote connectivity into your Exchange infrastructure. Verify OWA is working, verify Outlook Anywhere is working, verify EAS, verify SMTP mail flow, auto discover, single sign-on with Office 365. You definitely want to check out this tool if you haven't seen it before. www.exrca.com, that'll redirect to the tool's homepage, and it's pretty self-explanatory at that point. Then after you've validated the environment, then you'll go ahead and update the schema with the schema changes from 2013. Again, you can do that independently, or you could, if you wanted to, simply proceed with your first server install, and that'll be some of the first tasks that setup will do is go ahead and do the schema changes for you. Then you'll deploy your Exchange 2013 servers. Now, interestingly, unlike all previous versions where we always wanted you to deploy CAS first, in 2013 it's the opposite. We always prefer you to deploy Mailbox first. It's not a requirement, but we prefer it because it's going to provide a better experience for you. Remember, the CAS is just a lightweight protocol proxy now. It doesn't have any objects, any business logic, nothing to it. It's just proxying to a Mailbox server that has all that stuff. So until you install your first Mailbox server, you can't configure anything. There's no objects, there's no remote PowerShell endpoint, you can't do anything with it. So our preference to make your experience better would be to put your Mailbox server out there first, then you get all that configuration benefits, and then deploy CAS and then Mailbox in any order. If you mess this up and deploy CAS first and Mailbox, nothing bad will happen. Everything will be fine. You just won't be able to access the Exchange Administration Center or PowerShell until you've got at least one 2013 Mailbox server somewhere in the org. So then you'll obtain and deploy certificates, and if you were at the HA session and the architecture session, you know that we've made things much easier for you. We've eliminated a lot of the namespaces that we had in 2010 that you would need to put on your certificates. And one thing that you may have also noticed is now here we are partway through the upgrade process going from 2010 to 2013, you may have picked up on the fact that there's no legacy namespace that comes into play. We don't need that for 2010. We do need it for 2007, and I'll walk you through that in a bit, but for 2010, you don't need the legacy namespace. You just continue using the same namespace, you just repoint it towards your 2013 servers, and 2010 can coexist using a single namespace with 2013. Beautiful stuff. So after you've got the certificates in play, that's when you would go ahead and switch that namespace over. So whatever you're using, you change DNS to now point to the virtual IP that's in front of your CAS array for 2013. And you would verify once again using the remote connectivity analyzer. This way, along each path, you know whether or not things are being successfully configured. Then at that point, go ahead and build out your DAG if you're deploying DAGs, or if you're not, just make sure your mailbox servers are there, and you can start moving mailboxes in and cutting people over from 2010 to 2013. And that's largely all that's involved, except for the public folder migration process, which I'll talk about in a bit. All right. And then, of course, you would, repeat for the non-internet facing sites. It's exactly the same steps. All right, so going from 2007 to 2013, the steps are almost the same. There's just a couple places where things are different, and I've highlighted them in yellow for you to make it easy. And, of course, they're all going to involve the legacy namespace and having new certificates being put on the 2007 servers. You don't have to put new certificates on the 2010 servers because you're using the same names. But in 2007, you will. So, of course, just like in 2010, you'll have to start with getting that coexistence update rolled out throughout the organization, so all legacy servers have to have this installed. Once it's installed, you can verify the environment with the remote connectivity analyzer and then go ahead and do the schema updates for AD. Then deploy your mailbox and CAS servers, mailbox first preferably, and then here's where things diverge a little bit. Now here for 2007, you have to make a legacy namespace, so that's going to mean creating a namespace in DNS, associating an IP with it, having certificates reissued so that they include the legacy namespace, and then, of course, deploying those certificates in all the appropriate places, on the 2013 CAS servers, on the 2007 CAS servers, and any reverse proxies that may be in between the client and those servers as well. Then the next step is pretty much the same. Move the namespace over, verify once again with the remote connectivity analyzer, build out the DAG, and then start moving the mailboxes. After that, everything's largely identical. And then, of course, repeat with the non-internet facing sites. So it's a very simple and straightforward process. But let's look at each of these steps a little bit more in depth. So let's start with coexistence updates. Again, these are required updates. If they're not on the box, setup will detect that, and we won't proceed with the installation. Okay, so they have to be on every server. So yes, that's going to be some extra work that you have to do because if you're in a very large environment with a lot of Exchange servers, that's a lot of service pack and update rollups that you're going to have to deploy. Once you've finally done that, though, then you can go ahead and proceed with the Active Directory schema updates and then validate once again using the remote connectivity analyzer. Even if you're not doing an upgrade in coexistence, I always recommend that you validate your environment periodically with the remote connectivity analyzer anyway, because whether you're running 2007 or 2010, this tool can still do valuable things for you. It can make sure that SMTP is working. It can make sure that all the other protocols are working as expected. So it's not just a tool designed for upgrade and coexistence. It's designed to validate all sorts of protocol access into an Exchange environment. So the next step would be to install the mailbox and CAS servers, and that'll be done a little differently from how you've done it in the past. In the past, we had two setup executables, setup.com for the command line install and setup.exe for the GUI install. We've consolidated them both into one, so there's only setup.exe now. There's no more setup.com. So setup.exe will launch the GUI if you start it without parameters, and it will launch the command line version of setup if you start it with parameters. It's pretty much that basic. So you're going to install mailbox in CAS. You're going to do mailbox first so that you can get those objects in play and have things ready to configure once you do have CAS and the other prereqs installed. And then you can see that the switches are very similar to what you had. We still have the slash mode switch. We still have the slash role switch, although we only have the two roles now, so it's C for CAS or M for mailbox, MT for management tools still. But at the command line, we do have this one new switch, and you can see it up here. It's I accept Exchange Server license terms. Yes. That's in there to make sure that we get the affirmative agreement to the license agreement as you're installing. So unlike some of the other switches, for instance, mode, you could do slash M, roles, you could do slash R, organization name, you could do slash ON and things like that. There's no abbreviation for the license term acceptance. You have to type the whole thing out. It's not case sensitive, yay for at least that, but every character has to be exactly right and no spaces and so forth. And if you don't do it, it's not a recognized setup option and setup will fail. So just keep that in mind, particularly if you're scripting installs. It's not just, for instance, on the first server that goes in. It's every command line install that you do has to have this switch in it. All right, so the next part is the legacy namespace. For those of you who've already gone from 2007 to 2010, you've already gone down this road once, and you know what this path looks like. It's a very simple path, but it is extra work. You have to come up with a new name. Now, a lot of customers took us quite literally, and they actually use legacy dot whatever their domain is. And that's fine. There's no requirement on the names. It just has to be a valid FQDN. There's nothing hard-coded that's looking for the word legacy. We just call it the legacy namespace. But some people really prefer to use that because it's so literal and it tells them right at a glance what that is being used for. So if you want to use legacy.yourdomain.com, you can do that too. Whatever you use, though, it's got to be something that's in DNS. It's got to be something that is on the certificates. Not just on the new servers, but the old servers, because it'll be the old servers that ultimately will use that namespace. And if they don't have that in the certificate, you won't have an SSL termination endpoint. So it's required. And then, of course, once you've done that, you will validate with the remote connectivity analyzer again. Now, there is some validation you could actually do internally simply by manipulating the host file. Say, for instance, on the administrator's workstation. You can test a few things out that way. But you really aren't going to be certain things are working from an external perspective until you test it from outside the office. And you can either wait until you go home later that night, or you could do it through EXRCA, which is, in fact, why it was designed. Okay, the next step, it's getting those certificates. Now, I always tell people anytime you have to go and have a certificate reissued because you're adding a name to it, go and try and make a deal with your certification authority. Some of them may be open to doing this. They might not charge you the full price of the entire certificate just to make a quick change like adding a name. They might, you know, some do. But I always think it's worth a shot to ask. I mean, the worst they can do is say no. And if they do say no, you're just buying the certificate you had to buy anyway. So you might as well ask and see if you can get a discount, because it is kind of a hassle to go back, particularly if you've just deployed 2007 or 2010 recently and you just got those certificates. It's always a good idea to try and ask for sort of a little freebie that way. But either way, you're going to have to go and get them. We do try to make it much easier for you. We do continue our improvement on the certificate experience. So in the Exchange Administration Center, for example, we have this end-to-end certificate wizard. It's somewhat similar to what we had in Exchange 2010 inside the Exchange Management Console, but it's in a much more web-friendly and a much more modern type of environment. And it's going to do everything that you need with respect to the certificates that could be required for client access from an Exchange perspective. The other thing that we do, which is new, is we now have certificate notification, or certificate expiration notification. So when the administrator logs in to the EAC, if they're within 30 days of certificate expiry, we will give them a pop-up notification and they will see that right away. And then every day until that certificate expires, we will continue to notify them. So this makes things easier. You don't have to have a separate schedules or separate alarms or a separate system for managing your certificates. When the certificate gets close to expiring, the system will tell you. The administrator could go ahead and renew it. Once it's renewed, you're covered for the next X years. Our best practices remain the same as what they were in 2010. You want to minimize the number of certificates that you use. Why? Because certificates cost money, and you want to keep your costs low. So you want to minimize them, and the way to do that is to minimize the number of names that go on that certificate. Now, generally, there's two types of certificates that'll support multiple names. A wildcard certificate, which could be anything.microsoft.com, and a subject alternative name or SAN certificate, which is a cert that might say autodiscover.microsoft.com, mail.microsoft.com, and maybe in a legacy environment, legacy.microsoft.com. Our preference, our strong preference, is always going to be a SAN certificate. Wildcard certificates are supported, but generally they're a bad idea because of the security implications that they present. A wildcard certificate, again, is anything.microsoft.com, which means if a malicious entity were to get a hold of that certificate, they could spoof any system in the entire Microsoft.com domain. So it's actually for that reason that Microsoft will never issue itself a wildcard certificate. We will never use them at Microsoft because of those security implications. Some customers are fine with those implications, though, and they still use them and we still support them. But if you're buying a new certificate today, we would strongly recommend getting a SAN certificate. It accomplishes the same goal as a wildcard certificate, but it doesn't expose you to additional security risks. Now, validating once again. You're going to validate that you've created the proper legacy namespace, and you're going to configure your new load balancers as well. If you were in the architecture session, you know that the load balancing requirements for Exchange have changed dramatically going from 2010 to 2013. We no longer need session affinity. We did in 2010, and of course in 2007, but we need it especially in 2010 because of the architecture of the system. Since we've re-architected everything so that everything associated with that mailbox now happens on the same server, that means the session is always there as well. So even as the client bounces around from client access server to client access server or load balancer to load balancer, the session remains because it's still on that one server. Okay, so that means from a load balancing perspective, you don't need a load balancer that provides session affinity or layer 7 load balancing. You need one that provides simply TCP affinity, or what we sometimes call layer 4 load balancing. That means it's much less expensive. It's also much less complicated to manage. And it's going to be more scalable for you because it doesn't have the overhead of maintaining session state on the load balancer. We now maintain all of that on the Exchange server. You will make some minor changes. You will have to configure the auto discover service internal URI on the CAS servers to point over to the other legacy servers. But after you make that change, that's really largely all that's involved in that cutover to the load balancers. Then you're going to update internal and external DNS. Another strong requirement that we have is that you use what we call split DNS. Split DNS simply means that you have the same FQDNs in internal and external DNS servers. The only difference is the internal ones resolve to internal IPs, the external ones resolve to external IPs. That's a trick that not only minimizes the number of host names that you need, because again, you're using the same names internal and externally, but it also controls the Outlook connectivity flow as well. So without split DNS, if you just put one DNS record out there saying external DNS so that everybody internal and external can reach it, well, that will mean that internal Outlook clients that are now using HTTP to connect are going to go out your perimeter network in through your firewall and then off to the servers. You probably don't want traffic to flow that way. You want traffic to flow internally only, and split DNS is the mechanism that will help you achieve that. If you're not using split DNS, then I would strongly encourage you to reassess your DNS strategy, because it really provides you with so many benefits that using anything else is just going to make things harder for you. And then, of course, I hate to sound like a broken record, but after you've done this, you're going to validate once again with the remote connectivity analyzer, sort of each step along the way, just to verify that every configuration change you've made is good and valid. All right, so once you've have finished with the deployment, what does connectivity look like in the legacy coexistence sort of phase? So with 2010, it looks something like this. We've got a 2013 mailbox server, and in front of it, a 2013 CAS. Over here, we've got a 2010 mailbox server, and up above it is a 2010 CAS as well. So this is what your coexistent environment will look like. Everything will come through the front door of the new server. So all requests, because you move the namespace over to 2013, that mail.contoso.com request is going to go to the virtual IP being serviced by that load balancer. So communication will go into the load balancer. It'll be handled to one of the CAS, in this case, this one. CAS will then do a couple lookups. It'll look in Active Directory to see what version your mailbox is. And then it will look, if it's a 2010 or 2013 mailbox, it will then do an Active Manager query to find out where your mailbox is located. So if it's a 2007 mailbox, there is no Active Manager. We do just an AD lookup to find where the mailbox is. But here in the 2010 world, we're going to do first an Active Directory lookup to verify the version of the mailbox. And then once we've verified it's 2010 or 2013, we will go ahead and do an Active Manager lookup to find out where that mailbox lives. We found out that this user hasn't been migrated yet. They're still on 2010. So the CAS will send the request over to that, and the 2010 CAS will talk via RPC to the mailbox like it does today. And that's the communication path that you'll see that. Now, let's just say the 2010 server was in a different site. All of what you've seen so far is in the same single site. We go ahead and send the request in. We determine that the mailbox is over here in the second site. We send the request over to that second site, and that is done via a cross-site proxy request. It's very, very simple coexistence topology when you have 2010 in the mix. No legacy namespace, no redirection. We're simply just proxying over to the CAS. All right. Let's say, though, that this is an internet-facing site, though. In the previous example, it's not internet-facing. Now it's an internet-facing site. The behavior that we get is different now because it's internet-facing. We don't have to proxy that communication. We can go ahead and simply redirect it. So a user comes in. They go for mail.contoso.com. We find out that their mailbox is actually in a different site that is internet-facing, and we determine that by looking at the external URL parameters. Once we figured that out, we know that the URL for that site is europe.mail.contoso.com. So CAS will say, well, I'm going to redirect you to somewhere else because you've got a better CAS that you need to be talking to. Send the request over to the CAS in the remote site, which will respond to it and talk via RPC to the mailbox server. Again, a very simple, predictable type of communication flow. All right. For 2007, slightly different because, again, we've got that legacy namespace in play, and that is now what's front-ending the 2007 infrastructure. But the 2013 infrastructure knows about that because it's configured for where that legacy namespace should be directed to. So, again, similar type of concept. The request comes into OWA, goes to the layer 4 load balancer, to one of the CAS. CAS does the Active Directory lookup, finds out that it's a 2007 mailbox, and does an Active Directory lookup to figure out where that mailbox is, determines it's on the 2007 mailbox over here. We send the redirection request back up the stack. OWA client gets redirected over to the legacy namespace, and the request goes into the legacy CAS and gets processed by the legacy mailbox. And again, this is all happening in the same single site. If we have over here a non-internet-facing site where the mailbox might live, it's a very similar thing, same Active Directory lookup. We know where the mailbox is. We send the request back through redirection over to a 2007 in the same site, and that will then go ahead and send the request across site to a 2007 box, which will communicate with the store. Okay, so it's almost a similar path, except that we are using one of the legacy servers in the same site to do the proxying for us. We're not proxying directly from the 2013 CAS server to the 2007 server that's non-internet facing. If it were internet facing, of course, we would do this. We would redirect right over to it because we've got an endpoint that we can send the user over to. And you get your redirect instead of a proxy. So it's very, very similar to what we had moving from 2007 to 2010 in terms of the behaviors and the legacy namespace and whatnot. The client experience, as you saw, and the admin experience for that fact, is a little bit better in 2010 to 2013, but 2007 to 2013 is still a very smooth experience for admins and users. So what it looks like if you were to compare the two scenarios, though, you can see that it's a much, much cleaner type of coexistence with 2010. Almost everything in 2010 is going to be a proxy type of scenario in terms of coexistence. And then in 2007, the type of communication that you get between the two is largely going to depend on the protocol and the topology that you've configured, whether it be a proxy or redirect, or if auto-discover will need to come in and change some things. All right. The last thing, of course, is building out the DAG and moving the mailboxes. Moving the mailboxes is a little different. You still have the same online move mailbox that we had in 2010, but we now also have this migration service that we've introduced. And this migration service is there to allow you to move mailboxes in batches. So you get a bit of a more controlled migration, if you will. Some customers they saw when they were moving from 2007 to 2010, for example, particularly those customers who already had built out their DAGs across multiple data centers, they saw in some cases mailbox moves causing the replication pipeline to be throttled back so much so that it wouldn't get overwhelmed by the log activity. So now we give you the ability to have greater control over that and prevent that kind of thing from happening by simply scheduling the mailboxes to be moved in batches instead of just saying, here's a whole bunch of moves, go ahead and move them. You can do this from the shell, and you can do this from the Exchange Administration Center. So if you like using the GUI to move mailboxes, we still have full parity to do that there. All right, let's talk about public folder migrations. Now, I know the number of hands for those of you who wanted to continue using public folders in 2013 was significantly lower than the number of hands of those of you using public folders today. And that remains the same and consistent with responses that I've got previously when asking that question. So knowing that our supported clients are Outlook 2007 and later, you already know right away that public folders aren't a requirement at all. In fact, they may already not be a requirement for you to begin with. If you already have clients that are Outlook 2007 and later, public folders are not a requirement for you, not a technical requirement for you. Of course, they may be a business requirement for them. There may be a usage requirement for them. The information workers might just demand them, and that might be the requirement for them. But they're not required in 2013. If you want to use them, you can. They're there because some customers like the paradigm for collaboration that public folders provide. But those aren't the only choices that you have. SharePoint is one choice. And a combination feature within SharePoint and Exchange called site mailboxes is another choice. A site mailbox, as its name implies, is the combination of an Exchange mailbox and a SharePoint site. And you can send documents around and messages around to a team, to an org, people working on a project and so forth. And they can all collaborate using both tools from either tool. So, for instance, if I'm in SharePoint, I can send docs that will go to people through email. If I'm in email and Outlook, I can send messages with attachments, which will go to the other teammates in the form of taking the attachment and putting it in a SharePoint and replacing it with a link to the attachment in the mail message. And, in fact, that's how we separate the functionality. We store all the mail message items inside the mailbox, and we store all the Office files and other attachments inside the SharePoint site. And we put the two experiences together, both in SharePoint and in Outlook, to create what we call the site mailbox. So you have a lot of options. But if you do want to continue using public folders, they are there. They're a little different from the public folders we have today, but they're there. And most importantly, from the end user experience, it's going to be nearly identical. They won't really be able to tell any difference. The admin will know the differences because the admin has to do the migration, and there are specific steps that the admin has to do. And the admin will know because the way in which we implement public folders is completely different to how we've done it historically in the past. Well, not completely different, and let me explain why. So the way we implement them now is there's no public folder database. Public folders are now a type of mailbox. Okay, just like a user mailbox, public folders are simply a new type of mailbox. But that's actually not so different from how we implemented in the past. The public folder database that you all know and love, really that's nothing other than a mailbox database that has one mailbox in it that we specially replicate using a separate means. That's what the public folders are today in 2010 and earlier. It's one mailbox inside a public folder database that has special replication abilities. So we've moved away from having that extra database. And we've taken the public folders and we've made them an actual mailbox inside the mailbox database. And this has some pretty good implications. First, it means there's no separate replication mechanism. The concept you know of public folder replication doesn't exist in 2013. It also means that because it's a mailbox in a mailbox database, if you want to host it in a DAG, you get all the high availability and site resilience protections that you get from a DAG for public folder databases, without the strange restrictions we had, for example, in 2007, and without the disparate recovery scenarios that we had in 2010. So you get all the benefits of having it be a mailbox by virtue of the protection mechanisms we extend to mailboxes. Now, in implementing it as a mailbox, it's actually a series of mailboxes, that does change the architecture internally. Okay, obviously, public folder replication is gone, but more significantly, we're not using a multi-master model anymore. We use a single master model. Now, I understand that there are geographic benefits to the multi-master model, but the reality is going from a multi-master to a single master model works better for public folders because it completely eliminates any potential for conflicts, and it completely eliminates any potential for replication collisions. So it's a much more modern type of system. Now, there's two types of public folders. The first public folder mailbox you'll create is what we call the hierarchy mailbox. That's where the tree lives, the writable copy of the tree. Each subsequent public folder mailbox you create is what we call a content mailbox. How many content mailboxes you want or need is up to you. You control how large your first content mailbox grows. If it grows bigger than what you'd like, you create another content mailbox and create new content there. Obviously, as a single master model, that content lives in one place and only one place. So when a client goes in and they request that information, they will talk to one public folder mailbox. All public folder mailboxes will have a copy of the hierarchy, but the content will live in one place. Based on what the hierarchy response is, that client will then go and talk to whatever public folder mailbox has the actual content in it. Okay, and that's public folders in a nutshell. Now, the experience, though, for migrating, it's a cutover experience. You won't use both systems simultaneously. At any given time, you'll either use the old system or you'll have cut over and you'll be using the new system. And yes, there is a way to cut back. If you move to the new system, you decide you don't want to keep going forward, you want to go back to the old system, you can do that. But all the changes that you've made up until that point are in the new system and they don't come back with you. If you revert back, you're reverting back basically to the day you cut over. So, let's see what that looks like. Well, the first thing you're going to do is analyze your existing public folders, and we're going to have a tool for you to do that. And the tool will go in and tell you things like how big the folder is, when was it last accessed, and so forth. And that'll start to give you a pretty good idea as to how often certain sets of data are being accessed and used in your public folder system. And of course, once you know that, that gives you the idea as to how useful that information is to the information workers. Obviously, if it's not being accessed, it can't be very important. And if it's not that important, you might not need to carry it forward. So this is a good way to sort of clean house, if you will, before you start migrating all the data over. Then you'll copy the public folder data, and this is a process that will happen in the background, so users will still continue to access the old public folder system, and data will simply be replicated from the old system to the new system in the background as they're doing work. Then eventually you will need to quiesce those changes. So you will have this hard cut over where users are no longer talking to the old system and you will flip a switch and cut over and everybody will start using the new system. And then of course it's at that point that from the end user perspective, they may not notice that anything has changed. Because when they open Outlook, they'll see the same folders that they expect. It'll be the same tree, perhaps missing some of the data if you didn't migrate everything over because it wasn't needed, but it'll be the same basic experience. So when they come in, they can access that public folder right away, and they'll have no idea that instead of accessing a public folder database on some legacy server, they're now accessing a mailbox on some newer server. They'll have no idea. Only you will know because you'll be the one to implement that. And then again, as I mentioned, if you did want to go back, you can do that. But of course, you're going back to the old system as it was in its frozen pre-cutover state. And then you can move forward from there. But anything that you've done in the new system would be lost. And it would be up to the admin to try and figure some way to extricate that to export it back, maybe dragging and dropping through Outlook files or folders if you want. Now, managing coexistence, again, this should be no surprise because this is how we've done it in several previous versions. You're going to manage the new servers using the new management tools. That's the Exchange Administration Center or the Exchange Management Shell for 2013. For the legacy objects, you're still going to use the legacy management tools. So if you have 2010 servers, 2010 mailboxes in your environment, you're going to use the Exchange Management Console, the Exchange Management Shell, and possibly the Exchange Control Panel as well. So always use the version of the management tools to manage the version of the servers that it came with. So in terms of the upgrade and coexistence summary, I think I've kind of hammered all the major points home. If you have any questions, you can ask me later about that, because I want to move on to the virtualization area and just make sure, check how we're doing on time here. Okay, oh yeah, plenty of time. Okay, let's talk about virtualization. Remind me again how many of you are virtualizing Exchange today? All right. How many of you want to continue virtualizing Exchange? All right, great. So I'm glad I stuck this in. This wasn't originally going to be part of this session, but I wanted to include it because, after all, virtualization is rather a deployment platform, and I think it belongs in the deployment and coexistence scenario. All right. So why are we talking about virtualization? I don't have to tell you. All your hands went up. You know why we're talking about it, because you want to virtualize Exchange for a variety of reasons. Maybe you've bought some really powerful hardware, and the only way you can leverage that hardware is to carve it up into smaller pieces. Or maybe your management has said that we're standardizing on virtualization platform X, and therefore every application server that we deploy, including Exchange, must be virtualized on application X or whatever and so forth. And so that's fine. Whatever got you to here, we're here with you. You can virtualize Exchange 2013 just as you could 2010, just as you could 2007, just as you could 2003 as well. Many people don't realize how long we've been virtualizing Exchange for. So Exchange 2013, though, sort of continues the path that we had with 2010. Okay, it's not virtualization aware. There are some tools like XPPA, for instance, can tell if it's in a virtual environment or whatnot. But by and large, when you run the setup code, setup has no idea if it's in a virtualized environment or if it's being installed on physical hardware. Setup just verifies the prerequisites, and as long as the platform meets them, setup will continue and do its thing. So what are some of the, well, I think my battery's died here. What are the supported virtualization platforms? Okay, very similar to what we had with 2010. In 2010, it was 2008 SP2 and 2008 R2. Now in 2013, it's 2008 R2 and Windows Server 2012. And of course, the Hyper-V server equivalents of those as well. You don't have to get the whole operating system with Hyper-V. If you just want to do Hyper-V Server 2012, that's supported. If you wanted to do Hyper-V Server 2008 R2, that's supported as well. We also support third-party hypervisors, as we did with 2010. So any 64-bit hypervisor that meets the system requirements for Exchange that is listed on our Server Virtualization Validation Program, SVVP, that is a supported hypervisor. To get on SVVP, a third-party vendor has to come to Microsoft, and they have to demonstrate that their hypervisor is accurately representing what Windows would expect from a physical server. So they have to pass all of these validation tests, much in the same way we would validate earlier versions of Windows with the Windows Server catalog and the hardware compatibility list and so forth. It's that kind of validation that we do. But it's not enough to have the validation. To get on SVVP, that vendor also has to sign a joint support agreement with us, because we don't have any visibility into their hypervisor code any more than they have visibility into our hypervisor code. But we want the ability to jointly support you as you run these two different products from two different vendors together. So we work with each other. That joint support agreement means that you can call either vendor. You can call your hypervisor vendor, or you can call us. And we will work together to help solve whatever the issue is. So instead of like finger pointing or hanging up and saying, go call them, it's their problem, we work together. We bring them into the calls and we all manage the support case together. We all work for you together. So they have to do certain things to get on that list. It's not just technical requirements that we're going for. We're going for folks who are helping us support the community and the customers as well. Now it says all exchange roles can be virtualized. It's really both. It's silly to say all when there's two. So both roles can be virtualized. You may have noticed that we haven't talked about role co-location yet. We don't have that guidance yet. We don't know if we're going to prefer you to deploy single roles versus multi-roles. We're still working that out. And that's in part because you may be aware that as we develop software, particularly server-based applications, we don't really do a lot of the performance work until towards the very end. It doesn't really make any sense at all to start working on performance stuff with all the code churning and check-ins happening and whatnot. So we wait till we're at a very stable phase in the development, and that's when we start doing all the performance work and coming up with the performance and deployment guidance for you. So you'll see that kind of stuff coming around RTM and just after RTM timeframe as well. But until then, both roles can be virtualized, and the expectation is if you co-locate them, you'll be able to still virtualize them as well. Our storage support, that remains the same. We have to have block-level storage. Doesn't matter what's going on in terms of the storage stack and the type of storage that you buy. It just has to be block-level storage. It's the same type of support that we have. You have a plethora of storage options with Exchange 2013. SAN, DAS, JBOD, RAID, SATA, SAS, so many different options. They're all supported. Just make sure whatever you're using is block-level type storage. Host-based clustering or hypervisor-based clustering, that is supported just like it was in 2010. That also includes the ability to have mailbox VMs in a DAG be also part of a hypervisor or host-based cluster as well. Our position hasn't changed, though. From an Exchange high availability solution standpoint, our strong recommendation is always to use the Exchange HA built-in solution, the DAG and so forth, versus hypervisor high availability. Hypervisor high availability doesn't do anything for the Exchange data, doesn't tell you the difference between a good log or a bad log, doesn't tell you if your data is any good and so forth. We want you to still use the Exchange HA tools. For the migration capabilities that hypervisors have, that's the same support that we had in 2010. And of course, both roles are supported for those types of migrations. Be aware, there's different types of migrations. We still require the type that basically mirrors what would be effectively a cold shutdown of the server. And as we introduced somewhat recently with 2010, we are also supporting JetStress inside Exchange 2013 guests as well, which is key for you to be able to validate your storage solution pre-deployment. So that's a big win there as well. All right. Yeah, this really is dead. But I'll continue to push the button. All right. Things that aren't supported. You probably know that Exchange likes its own dinner. Okay, it doesn't like people eating from its plate. And it likes a pretty big plate because it has a lot of work to do. So we don't like this concept of overcommitting. I mean, virtualization brings this concept forward, and it's an interesting concept from, say, for instance, the development or a lab standpoint. But virtualization can't make resources appear that don't actually exist. So when you overcommit resources, when you say dynamically adjust memory or give the system more processing power than it appears to actually have, that doesn't really work well for a heavy production workload, particularly the dynamic memory stuff. And I'll talk about sort of the memory mess that you have when you go down that path. Other things, the hypervisor snapshots, again, excellent for labs and test environments and dev environments, devastating for production environments. You can't use them all because the snapshot, by its very nature, implies taking a system back in time at some point. And unless you're prepared to take your entire production environment back in time to that point, you won't be able to take individual servers back in time. And we'll talk about time traveling for servers in a bit. And snapshots use delta disks or what are sometimes called differencing disks as well. We don't use those in Exchange. We don't want those in Exchange. That's another area where we want a fixed resource of a specific size that we can depend on. We don't want storage to go away. And just like previous versions, we don't want you to install server-based applications on the root, on the hypervisor root machine itself. So don't put Exchange on there. Don't put SAP or Oracle or SQL Server or any other server-based apps. It's management apps only on the hypervisor root. Antivirus, backup, system center, you know, those types of management agent type stuff, but no server-based applications. In large part, that hypervisor system should be dedicated to servicing its guest machines. And the significant oversubscription of processors, we still have this stake in the ground where we don't want you to go more than 2 to 1. Don't allocate more than 2 virtual processors for every 1 physical core that you have. And that is actually the maximum. Many customers, they find, once they calculate the entire workload of all the guest machines, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about the processor ratio, it's not just for the Exchange machines on that hypervisor host, it's all the guests on that hypervisor host. And once they do the math, they realize that, well, I can't do 2 to 1 because I have too many machines, so I have to back off from that. Or I can't do 2 to 1 because the workload required by the machines is so great that they really can't share processor time that way. So you may find yourself actually more in a 1 to 1 ratio between virtual processors and actual physical cores. But don't go beyond 2 to 1 for the workload of the whole host. See, I'm still going to push that button, even though it doesn't work. So Windows Server 2012, its Hyper-V does add many new features. Some deployment blocking limits have been removed. Those of you who wanted to, for instance, deploy large mailbox servers, perhaps found yourself limited in previous versions of a Hyper-V because you could only allocate 4 virtual processors and no more in a Hyper-V environment. Well, now those limits are gone, so any scalability limits that were blockers preventing you from deploying Exchange inside a Hyper-V environment, all those limits are gone, and you can very easily and safely deploy in Windows Server 2012. I'm gonna put it down. That'll stop me from doing it. Okay, best practices, the memory mess. Okay, why is memory so important? Well, obviously memory's where the work gets done. So Exchange, as its nature, is doing a lot of work and it needs a lot of memory to do that. The phenomenon of dynamic memory is basically adjusting the amount of memory that the running system has at any given time. Now, Exchange doesn't support the NUMA extensions, and we don't support hot add memory. Okay, so what that means is, from an Exchange perspective, dynamic memory is really good about taking memory away from Exchange, but it can't give memory back to Exchange because we don't support dynamic memory. So as it takes memory away, our working set gets trimmed more and more and more until finally we're starved and we have no memory to do anything with. So what does something look like? So here's dynamic memory at work. Here's a performance capture of the system actually leveraging dynamic memory. And there's a lot of stuff going on, but if you pay particular attention to that yellow line, which is the average RPC latency, one of the key benchmarks that we use to determine how snappy the user experience is. Obviously, the higher the latency, the poorer or slower the experience is. And you can start to see that latency is pretty low. Then all of a sudden, as it gets to a certain point, latency starts going up and going crazy. So let's focus in on a couple counters in particular, and you can understand why that is. So the yellow line is still the latency. The blue line here is the available megabytes. And now you, of course, can see the correlation. The available megabytes were fine until dynamic memory came at about here, took a bunch away, and we ran out with nothing, and then all of a sudden, RPC average latency just went through the roof. Okay, so you can see how this removal of memory from Exchange, even though it sounds like a great feature from a hypervisor standpoint, removing the memory from the Exchange workload means that the end user experience is going to suffer considerably, and that Exchange is going to start doing things like paging out to disk because it doesn't have enough memory. And in this case, that means all of the work we've done literally over the past almost 10 years to constantly reduce our IOPS is going to do nothing for you because you're memory constrained and it now has no choice but to page to disk to do its thing. Okay, so dynamic memory, not supported for Exchange 2013. Don't use it. Here's one of the reasons why not. Here's another reason why not. Again, as the transition pages that are repurposed, you can see those are spiking again. Those are pages that should have been freed up and gone into the cache and made available for other ones. But because we were memory constrained, we couldn't put them in then, and we had to transition them and reuse them. So you can start to see all the different places inside the system where, as memory drops, as available bytes goes down, things become really bad from a performance standpoint. And of course, look what's happening with the working set as well. That's the actual amount of memory allocated to that process to do whatever work it needs to do. That just drops almost to the floor. And once you run out of that, then you're doing nothing but talking to disk. All right, time traveling. It sounds cool, but in reality, it kills an Exchange server. Okay, here's why. Every Exchange server on the planet, as long as it's running, has state. And it has state that depends on things that are locally stored in its persistent storage, and it has state based on information stored in Active Directory. That state has to match. If that state gets out of sync, it is impossible for you to fix that Exchange server. Your only choice at that point would be to throw that server away and use the setup recover server process to get new state stamped out of AD. Okay, so what happens with a snapshot? Well, a snapshot, and we're not talking about VSS snapshots, we're talking about hypervisor snapshots, which are somewhat similar. It's basically a capturing of the current state of the binary system. Okay, so it's a binary file that lives somewhere, and it can be loaded up and represented as that VM at that point in time. They're wonderful for lab environment. I use them all the time in my environment, but my environment is small. It's only got just a few Active Directory servers and just a few Exchange servers, and I intentionally throw the entire environment away by reverting to clean known snapshots so that I can put new builds on and move forward in test docs and things like that. Beautiful solution for a lab. I would hate to have to rebuild a Windows server every single time. But in a production environment, in order to do that, you have to take everything back, which means every Exchange server in your environment, which means every Active Directory server in your environment. You're probably not going to be able to do that. In fact, you're not going to be able to do that. You're just not going to be able to roll your environment back. Which means if you take one of the servers, anyone, it can be a directory server, it can be an Exchange server, if you take one of them and you send them back in time, such that their state no longer matches what the equivalent of a new state would be in the present from their perspective, you've irretrievably broken that machine. There is no way to fix that machine. You have to throw it away and start from scratch with recover server. Okay, so time traveling, it's no good in production, so it's not supported for production environments. Great for lab environments, but not supported for production environments. All right, and again, The oversubscription of CPUs. That's too much work, too little time. Okay, again, we need the CPU power to do the work as well. And if you oversubscribe, all you're doing is slowing down the system. Again, virtualization can't make resources magically appear from where they don't exist. And if you're oversubscribing, that's basically what you're saying. You're saying that I have such an understanding of this workload that I'm going to ensure that at any given time, that no one server is going to be exceeding the workload of X number of virtual processors. And you can't do that. There's no predictability whatsoever for a messaging system. You know, you may see patterns in the messaging system, but that doesn't mean you can predict it, because every email that's sent is an independent event. And statistically, there's no way to calculate the likelihood of those events continuing to occur. Therefore, there's no predictability possible in a messaging system. And so you can't, with any reason, say that at any given time, the workload for Exchange is going to be X. It might be X at that given time, but it could be something completely different. And because you have no way of knowing that, you have no way of planning for that. And planning for that is exactly what you'd be trying to do by oversubscribing the processors. So we do allow you to oversubscribe a little bit, and in large part, that's not really for production environments. That's there as a reflection of your ability to do what we call P to V migrations. When you take a physical server and migrate it into a virtual environment. That's the real reason we allow processor oversubscription, is to support those environments when you're consolidating multiple physical servers into the same virtual environment. We haven't been very clear on that, and so a lot of customers take that to mean, I can oversubscribe in my environment just fine. But in doing so, you're really bottlenecking the system, because you have no way to guarantee that whenever those processor cycles are needed, they'll be there for the system to do its thing. So most of you probably will end up with a one-to-one ratio between your virtual processors and your actual physical cores. Again, if you do oversubscribe, that is supported, but don't go greater than the 2-to-1 ratio that we've stated. All right. And with that, there is a lot of related content. I think actually we've delivered almost all these sessions by now. I do have immediately after this, from 11 to 11:30, I'll be in the speaker lounge for the meet and greet. And I do have, I think, 11 USB keys that have the Exchange 2013 preview on them. And so I'll probably give them to the first 11 people who show up at the speaker meet and greet. The first 11 people who show up who don't already have one, so don't come and get two. There's not a huge advantage to having these. They're 4 gigabyte sticks. Most of you probably have larger ones on you already, but it does have the 2013 preview on it, so it does save you an almost 4 gigabyte download. All right, with that, we do have a few minutes to take questions. I want to remind you, of course, of the track resources and the need to fill out your surveys. You may win a mouse, you might not, but either way, the survey is important to us. And we are, of course, giving that chair away still, so you still have time to go grab an orange shirt, strap in the chair, and try and land a plane quicker than anyone else without crashing. And then maybe you might win that chair to take it home with you. All right, don't forget to check out Channel 9. Thank you all for coming. And I hope to see you next year, too, and let's take some questions. Yes, sir. Great question. So the question is, with Link in the mix, is there anything that you'll have to account for in the migration? So the answer is probably. The certificate requirements around Link are different from the certificate requirements that we have for Exchange. Link, for instance, in the legacy servers, they required the server names of the certificates. We did not. They required greater than 1024 bitness. We did not. So you may have a solution where your certificates for Link are a little bit more expensive than the certificates you're using for Exchange, and you might have to do maybe some brokerage with your certification authority to see if maybe you can get some sort of combo certificate that meets the minimum requirements for both. And then that should in turn reduce your cost, because instead of buying the separate ones, you buy a single certificate with just the multiple names on it. Yes, you should be able to do it. Yeah, obviously, yes. They won't get the new experience until Link 2013 is in the mix. But the down-level experience would be preserved, just as we do on the mailbox side. So it would just be on the Link client side as well. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the question is, are the mailbox moves from 2010 to 2013 online? Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so no outage for the users. They won't know any difference. Things will move asynchronously in the background. Once we've got all the data, there will be a slight point at which the connected CAS will be disconnected, and then it will reconnect up to the new mailbox. But the user won't notice anything because they'll remain connected in through the load balancer to the CAS. Yes, the 2010 CAS will be actively used in the coexistence period for the proxy and redirection scenarios that I showed you. It won't be used for the mailbox moves. That would be the 2013 client talking to the down-level server and affecting and controlling the move that way. So we wouldn't use MRS on the legacy server. We would use it on the newest servers. Yes, sir. So the prechecks, are they just for that domain, or is it for the whole forest? It's the prereqs are org-wide, so it's the whole forest. So when setup runs, it's going to look in the Active Directory, and it's going to start looking at all the servers that you have, and it's going to do a version check on all the versions of those servers to make sure that they have the proper minimum required updates before setup will proceed. So it's checking everything. There's no getting around that. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
That is an excellent question. So if I've cut over my public folders and I forgot to take stuff with me, can I go back and get it? That's twice this week. You've stumped me on stage. You're out to embarrass me. Stop it. I will look that up and find out for you. I don't know off the top of my head. Because we do, once that cutover is done, we are basically shutting off MAPI access to that public folder system at the time. So let me see if there's a way to crack open that door and get some stuff that's missed without having to do a restore from backup and extracting some strange way. So send me that an email and I'll find an answer for you. Yes?
Is there going to be a release prior to RCM where coexistence is supported with old versions?
Say that one more time.
Is there going to be a release? So currently the preview doesn't support any coexistence scenarios?
Correct. Prior to RTM, no, because we don't support anybody in production prior to RTM except folks in our technology adoption program. So we won't be making any coexistence updates available for you to do that, except that, as I said earlier, we think that maybe RU8, which is already out there, is going to be the one for 2007, but we haven't locked on that yet. So it could change to a later date. So for now, between now and RTM, there's really no coexistence that you can do. It'll all be post-RTM once those bits are available and the coexistent updates are all signed off and we've announced that these are the ones that you need. That's when you can start doing coexistence. Yes? Yes, the public folders that you saw can still be mail enabled and they can still receive messages.
So for migration, is there an easy way to migrate just
Yes, when you do the copy of the data, that's also going to copy the properties for the folder as well. So if there's an SMTP alias associated with it, that'll go with it. And the client permissions will go with it, and they'll translate into the same permissions that users expect in Outlook as well. Yes? So that's internal. There's a commandlet that you'll run in 2013 that will start the data copying for you. Yes? Yes? Great, so the question is, with the CAS server being re-architected and being the lightweight protocol proxy now, is it now appropriate to have it be in a perimeter network? So no, that's not supported. CAS is still an internal domain joined to the internal 84 type of machine. So perimeter network, yes, you would still be using a reverse proxy for that. Whether or not that would be TMG would be up to you. You may have read that we announced yesterday end of life for TMG, so that may affect your deployment plans. We are persisting the UAG offering, so that is not affected by the forefront announcement yesterday, but TMG would be end of life, so you may want to consider a different reverse proxy solution, maybe UAG or something else. Yes, sir. Are there going to be any changes with backup or AV? So in terms of backup, it's still a VSS backups only. We don't have the streaming backup. We dropped that before 2010. So it's VSS backups only. We still have, of course, Exchange native data protection. So that's using all the replication and other features. So if you don't want a backup, you don't have to. We'll have the plugin for Windows Server backup included on the mailbox server. And of course, DPM and the third-party solutions are working with us, and they will have offers for 2013 as well. In terms of AV, the VS API is gone from the store, so you want to use web services if you want to go in there and do some sort of inspection on the content or the properties. So if you are using VS API now, you will have to get a new solution that doesn't include that and uses an alternate method. Great questions. All right, we've got time for one more from somebody not as smart as Paul. Yes. Okay, Paul.
Someone in the row behind you here might want to know if Windows NLD is going to be still supported for CAS load balancing.
Well, it's not supported in 2010, so
but I didn't know. Yes. I'll just say yes. That is our plan. That is our hope. You could have used it with 2010. We didn't recommend it because the workload characteristics were very different. And, of course, it didn't provide session affinity, which meant if you did want to use it, you were still buying some other fancier load balancer on top of that. So it didn't have the scalability stuff that we need, and it really didn't have the feature set that we needed. But now that doesn't apply. I mean, when you think about it, we just need a load balancer for three things in 2010, for the session affinity, for the obviously balancing of the load itself, and then for the service ping to let us know if things are healthy. Well, we don't need the session affinity anymore. So all we need is something that can spread a TCP load around and something that can periodically heartbeat a service endpoint. So as a result of that, NLB now does become a more palatable option. It's not something that we're testing at large scale, but it is something that would be supported. We're also trying to work out how we might be able to support just round-robin DNS, but I don't know that that'll be there at RTM, but we are looking at ways where we can even further simplify the load balancing stack. All right. Thank you for the proxy question. All right, I'm off to the speaker lounge. Feel free to follow me there. Otherwise, thank you for coming, and I hope to see you next year. Cheers.